Ooh. My goodness. Only a few questions. People's meditation must be very good today. You can always tell how good the meditation is by how few questions there are. The depth of the meditation is inversely proportional to the amount you think.
No, this meditation is going very well. So, are we all ready? The first question this evening. Here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, the last few days I've been maintaining sustained awareness of the breath, and it was becoming interesting and attractive. Today I can't sustain awareness of the breath. The other way around. Let's start again. The last few days I've been maintaining sustained awareness of the breath, and it was becoming interesting and attractive. Today I can sustain awareness of the breath, but the breath seems blank and uninteresting. What is happening? Okay, the interest of the breath. Sometimes you're getting bored, so you're doing the same old thing again. The solution is do the breathing backwards meditation. Make it a little bit more interesting. But also you'll find some days the breath is not so interesting. Sometimes it really is interesting. Is there anything to do with the breath? No. It's one's mindfulness sometimes gets a little bit dull. Other days it gets very bright. Sometimes one's energies are really strong. The mental energies, sometimes they're weak. And if the mental energies, the awareness, the mindfulness is not empowered, then the breath looks really boring and uninteresting. Just like the carpet. But when the mindfulness gets very strong, not just the carpet looks beautiful, this breath, wow. Breathing in, that's amazing. Breathing out, wow, that's cosmic. Whatever it is, because the mindfulness gets strong and empowered, whatever you do, whatever you see, becomes full of interest. So it's not the breath's fault, it's just the mindfulness. And the mindfulness is not your fault, it's just nature. So the idea is don't complain. Make peace. So it's not doing well today. Fine. Remember that little simile which I gave. I mentioned it to a few people in the interviews. That simile of going to work. You go to work on a Monday. You work very hard. And at the end of the day, you get nothing. You go home empty-handed. So you go there out of faith on Tuesday. You work hard all day for your boss. And at the end of the day, you still get nothing. The same happens on Wednesday. You work and you get nothing out of it. And by Thursday, you're beginning to think, what am I doing this for? But you still go to work on Thursday. And you still come home empty-handed. And you think, oh, I might as well go on Friday as well. It's pretty much a waste of time. And on Friday, like most people in Australia, don't work all that hard on a Friday. But at the end of Friday, the boss gives you a check, a paycheck. And you think, oh, why can't every day be a Friday? Some people think they won't go to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, just go Friday work. And just get a paycheck every day they go to work. And unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. The reason why you get a paycheck is because Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, all that work, you're building up credit. And now, when you've got enough credit, you get the check. Now, this is the same as meditation. Some days you're meditating, and you get nothing out of it. You think, oh, I can't get any fun, the breath is not in my mind. Doesn't matter, it's just like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Carry on working. Make peace with every moment. And then the next day you're meditating, you don't expect anything, nothing different. And then, wow, bam, wham, nimittas, jhanas, wow, you get your paycheck. And you think, ah, now I know how to do it. And you think the next meditation is going to be the same, but it ain't. You've got to go back to work again and build up your credit. So, if what's happening there, you obviously got lots of paychecks the first few days, but today you have to work. Build up the credit and the paycheck comes soon. Does that make sense? Hope so, because that's all you're getting. Next question. Ajahn, when you die, where should one want to be reborn? E.g., to be born in the time of a Buddha, with metta. Okay, when you die, the answer to that question, you don't want to be reborn at all. If you get reborn again as a human being, you've got to go to school again. You've got to wear nappies again. Every time you cry, your mum will stick something in your mouth again, this pacifier. Oh, it's so much hard work. You think you've finished school and exams and all of that. You've got to start all over again. Oh, no. So when you die, it's best not to be reborn at all. What do you want to be reborn for anyway? Haven't you had enough yet? Oh, no. I want to get reborn again so I can fall in love again. Crazy. You want to get reborn so I can be young again. So I can... What do you want to do all this for? So when you really realize what's going on, you don't want to be reborn again. It's a waste of time. So it's not just where you want to be reborn. It's why you want to be reborn there. Why do people want to be reborn in these places? So the best thing is actually to realize all places where you could be reborn, they're just a complete waste of time. You be reborn as a rich person, as a poor person. Girls want to be reborn as men. Men want to be reborn as girls. I had one disciple here who just said, told me that when they die, they want to be reborn as a cat. What do you mean reborn as a cat for? They say because they don't have to go to work on a Monday morning. Just lie around all day. You watch the TV whenever they want to, on your lap. They get fed. And I said, but remember, cats in Perth, Western Australia, after the first few weeks of their life, they get sent to the vet. Do you want that to happen to you? Oh, maybe not. Maybe not. Yeah. Okay, next question. Dear Ajahn, twice I have seen this bright, brilliant light. When I went to bed, you haven't forgotten to switch off the bed light. No. I see this bright, blinding light when I went to bed. It happened at the beginning of the sleep in both instances. I woke up because the light was super bright. There was no dream, just this light. Can we possibly see an imitator even when we're not meditating? Please comment. Thank you. Yeah, this is actually, it's not uncommon. Because what has been happening? You've been letting go or building up momentum, but not enough letting go. And then you've gone to sleep and think, oh, I'll just give up now. Just go to sleep. And at that moment when you're laying down there, you're not doing anything, you're really letting go, you're not even trying to meditate. And so at that point, the mind which is being empowered all day long, it can come up then, because you're allowing it time, space to come up, because you're letting go, you're not doing anything, you're giving up. That's why it comes up. It doesn't come up for very long, because it hasn't got enough momentum yet, but it shows you just how to get nimittas up. Which is one of the reasons why I say, whenever you get tired, go and take a rest. Keep going to bed 5 or 6 times a day. And then you've got all these wonderful experiences. It's called the Ananda practice. Many of you know that story. Ananda was trying hard to become enlightened. Couldn't do it, so he decided to go and take a rest. And before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened. So you can try that way. Now the point was, when you first lay down to go to sleep, you let go. You're not trying anymore. You've been trying all day and now I'll give up. Now's the time, the work is finished, all the hard striving is gone, now I'm going to give up. Imagine doing that throughout the whole day. The same mind state when you lay down and go to bed. Relaxing, not striving, not wanting anything, not trying to do anything. Get that mind state right now. The same mind state when you just lay down and go to sleep. After a hard day's work. Relax, let go. You open the mind up. You're not doing anything. That's called a mind of non-attachment. It's a mind of non-craving. A mind of non-doing. It allows the limiter to come up. Yeah, of course it happens. Trouble is, though, if it happens very often, the limiter is so bright, you can't go to sleep. I was telling a story today to somebody that sometimes the nimittas can come up in your sleep, especially if you've been doing a lot of meditation. Many years ago, I had this dream. I was walking with Ajahn Yanadamo, and we went past these shrines of these famous monks. And he went on ahead, and I got so inspired. I stopped by one of these shrines, and as soon as I saw
the name on the shrine. Just got so much energy. Got this huge nimitta coming up. And of course, that was the end of my sleep. I was bag sitting up and just fully alert. Great way to wake up with a nimitta. I can recommend it. Anyway, that's something else. Any questions on that? Next question. Ajahn Brahm, where is the line between diligent and controlling and between let be and being lazy and no effort? Yeah, the line is where there's an ego and where there's no ego. Where there's self and non-self. That's where the line is. This is all actually part of the Buddha's teachings of anatta. There's no one in here, so what do you think you're doing? Who's doing all of this? It's only craziness. You know there's a person, this being in Buddhist cosmology called Mara. M-A, Arthur Robert A. Mara. And Mara lives in this realm of the beings who control other beings' creations. The paranimitta Wasawati. Wasawati means real power, control over others. Now that's the evil one. He is the control freak in chief. So whenever you try and control things, you're actually just, you know, giving yourselves under the power of Mara, always wanting to control things. But as soon as you let go of control, then Mara is gone. Can't find you. So this is actually an amazing bit of cosmology, because it's in a metaphor there of actually what is the problem here. What is the evil thing, this controlling? Because it's always coming from a self. When there's a mine, what you think you own, that's what you tend to control. That's my business. And therefore, you want to control it. If it is your car, that's my business. I control it. You keep away. Some of you have already got my meditation area. And some of the people sitting next to you are encroaching. Get out of here. It's my area. And whenever there's a me and a mine, this is where we start controlling. So when you call it letting go, is I don't own anything. I don't own my body. So I let it go. Whatever it wants to do, it can do it. And then if you can really be sharp and courageous, I don't own my meditation. Nothing to do with me. Anatta. That's my new definition of anatta. None of this, no self business. Anatta means nothing to do with me. Not my business. Isn't that wonderful? Not my business. Not my business, you just give it away. So meditation is not my business. So you just forget about it. You do nothing. And then meditation happens. It's nature's business, and it does it much better than I can ever meditate. So the line between controlling and letting go. When you're controlling, it's craving, it's doing. Being diligent means being diligent in not controlling. Being diligent in making sure the defilements of the mind. Well, what are the great defilements of the mind? Greed and hatred, desire and ill will. Is it a controlling business? I want, I want, I want. I don't want, I don't want, I don't want. That's all to do with craving. That's all to do with controlling. Imagine you don't want anything. There is an interesting quote. This is another way of how to stop controlling. There was an interesting quote which somebody brought up several years ago, because they knew I was a scientist. And it was a famous saying of Lord Kelvin. There are some engineers here, and engineers should know Lord Kelvin, because he was one of the founders of engineering and technology in Britain. He gave his name to the scale of absolute temperature. Minus 273 degrees centigrade is zero on the Kelvin scale. Remember that? And he once quote said, it was a very great insight into how you actually start this technological revolution, the industrial revolution in Europe. He said, in order to control nature, you have to learn how to measure it accurately, first of all. So the start of technology was having like standards of measurement. proper standards of measurement. Because once you could measure accurately, then the way was forward for technology to control the universe. And when I heard that, I turned it around like I usually do. I said, yeah, to be able to control, you have to measure first. So what happens if you stop measuring? If you stop measuring, you can't control. So if you want to let go of the controller, stop measuring. Stop measuring your meditation. Good meditation, bad meditation. As soon as you have those measurements, you are going to control. Stop having these measurements. 10 minutes, half an hour. If you start measuring that, you start controlling. Come on, another 10 minutes. Come on, I'm going to beat my record. Come on. More controlling. You start measuring. This is peaceful. This is restlessness. And then you control. As soon as you say that, restlessness bad, peace good, you try to hold the peace. You try and get rid of the restlessness, more controlling. So how about not measuring anything? Just watching this moment and accepting it for what it is without any discrimination. In the same way, throughout this retreat, I haven't measured any one of you. I haven't said, you're good, you're bad, you're a good meditator, you're sloppy, you're diligent, you're lazy. I haven't measured anybody. But have you measured yourself? If you've been measuring yourself, you are the control freak. You have given the cause for controlling. So stop measuring. So you sit here, I'm not going to measure this meditation moment. Whatever it is, it's all right by me. No good, no bad, no peace, no restlessness. I'm not even going to measure it. Then you find there's nothing you can do. The hands of control are tied. You cannot do anything. And when you can't do anything, the whole world stops. You've gone to the measureless samadhi. Beyond measuring. That's actually part of loving kindness. If you do loving kindness, you go to the immeasurables. That's what immeasurable means. When you have loving kindness, what is actually loving kindness? You stop measuring people. I love you for who you are. The door of my heart's open no matter who you are. No matter what you do. All that measuring into those qualities I like, those I don't like, I accept you, I reject you. Those are all gone. Because they're all gone, you're immeasurable. Everyone is the same. All accepted. Now you do that loving kindness to this moment. Whatever it is, really dull, really brilliant, lazy, diligent. I'm not going to measure anything. The door of my heart's open to me when I'm really lazy. My door of my heart's open to me as equally as much when I'm diligent. Then you're not measuring anymore. Then you're not controlling. Then you're at peace with everything. Then strange things happen when you're not controlling. Letting be becomes natural. Energies arise. You get into jhanas. The immeasurables. Where jhana becomes beyond the world, beyond measuring, beyond control. Great way in. So stop measuring. Okay, so that's the line between controlling and letting be, measuring or not to measure. Any comments about that one? Aha, next one. Dear Ajahn, what should one do if a deep meditation is disturbed by a sudden jolt? Just whoever jolted you, hit them back. No, you shouldn't do that. I was on a bench outside when a magpie took off almost brushing past my ears. No, you shouldn't hit the magpies. I found it harder to reach mindfulness afterwards. Oh, why? Just a magpie being a magpie, that's all it is. So it's very nice it brushed past your ears. It's just being kind, probably giving you a little peck on the ear, saying, "Ah, oh, you're so cute." And you got afraid. So, found it hard to reach mindfulness afterwards. Sometimes what happens is you get sort of jolted or get upset, and we don't let it go very easily. So just allow it to just disappear straight away. What was it that they were doing? Some, as a Davidson in the US, was doing these experiments on this Tibetan monk. And one of them was actually to have the sound of a gun going off right next to his ear and see what it did to his mind. And they found out that because of his training in meditation, sure, the, you know, the mind registered the sound, but it faded away very quickly. In other words, you could let go of the past just almost immediately. Bang! But then you went soft again. Very, very quickly. So the jolt did not resonate inside. For many people, the jolts resonate because we cling on to it. Why did the magpie do that? That's not fair. It shouldn't have happened to me. I'm just getting into jhana. Wow, it's not fair. I'm so unlucky. Whatever it is, just don't allow these things to resonate. As soon as they arise, let them go. It's called being in the present moment. So those of you who know how to stay in the present moment, these things don't resonate. As soon as it arises, it's almost immediately let go. It doesn't bounce. I gave this simile, I think, somewhere, of having a mind like a padded cell. So whatever thoughts or experiences arise in there, they hit the wall of your mind, they don't bounce like a ping pong ball. They hit the wall and they stop right there. So you don't resonate. You don't keep bouncing, ping pong, ping pong, ping pong, when magpie hits you. Magping, magpong, magping, magpong, magping, magpong. It doesn't keep on going, it stops. That's what you should do. The next time, present moment awareness. When the magpie is there, yeah, you get sort of jolted. But as soon as the magpie has flown off, the jolt flies off with the magpie. You don't keep it. Okay? Next question. Dajan Brahm, as a Buddhist, should one give constructive criticism? Or is this only one way of dressing up one's judgmental qualities? In lay life, this becomes a problem in keeping one's precepts very pure. Please comment. Okay. Now, constructive criticism. Should one give constructive criticism? Is criticism or constructive? I think this is one of the oxymorons, isn't it? Because most criticism is destructive. But we sort of call it constructive criticism to try and dress it into, you know, something nice. But I think a lot of times the criticism is usually destructive. So instead of having destructive criticism, I think that as a Buddhist you have constructive praise. So forget all the things which people are doing wrong. But when they're doing something right, praise them. Say, well done. Every time your boss gives you a raise, oh, well done, boss. Thank you very much. But every time he doesn't give you a raise, keep quiet. So the point is, praise is by far a more powerful stimulus to goodness than criticism. Because imagine you're criticized. Look, all of you who have been in the interviews, have I ever criticized you at all? Sometimes people come in and say, my mind's been all over the place. And I've said, good. Have you heard me say that? Sometimes you think, oh, I misheard, it must be crazy, it must be not listening to what I've been saying. I have been listening. My mind's been all over the place. Good, well done. Congratulations. I think, what are you talking about? And I'm saying, it's a present moment, just accept it. Praise it. Welcome it. Well done. Some people say they've been sleeping all the time. They haven't done any meditation at all. Well done. Congratulations. They've been eating too much. Ah, brilliant. Well done. Congratulations. Whatever it is, when you praise a person, they feel good. When they feel good, they feel peaceful. When they feel peaceful, they don't need to sleep so much or eat so much or be so lazy. So I'm using the negative psychology. Reverse psychology, that's what I meant to say. So do the destructive criticism, do constructive praise. You get much further in life with constructive praise. Okay? Next question. Dear Ajahn, if you say one has to let go of everything in order to become enlightened, how can a layperson live in the world with responsibilities? Is the monastic life the only sure way to get enlightened? Ha 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 ha. Somebody's got an insight. What would you want to live in the lay life for anyway? You know why it's called the lay life? Because you spend all day laying around.
Yeah, what do you want to live in the late life for anyway? Having to go to work on a Monday morning, having to keep a job, having a wife or a husband, having to do all that sort of stuff. Isn't it much more fun? Shaving your hair and going off to join a monastery. Having good fun. You don't reckon so? Nah. But anyway, doesn't matter. You have to let go of everything in order to become enlightened. So just let go of everything first of all and then see what happens. Because if you let go of everything, then you don't care whether you're a monk or in the lay world. It doesn't matter to you anymore. You let go of everything. Isn't that nice? So it doesn't really matter. So you let go of the questions as well. Next question. This is about the same writing. There's people just doing one question or two. No, I think that's the same question by the writing. Anyway, dear Ajahn, I'm sure if this is what you call nimitta, ooh, an experience. After settling down in meditation, I experience deep coloured flashes, sometimes rich purple, sometimes golden, coming and going with a bright spot in the middle to form another flash. I also experience this while listening to your talk. Am I imagining? Please advise. Thank you. Okay. Well, please forgive the dramatics. Well, I'm trying to make it interesting. Okay, the colour flashes and a spot in the middle. Yeah, this is sounds like nimitta, because after settling down in meditation, when people ask, is this a nimitta or not a nimitta, I have to ask many questions. And usually the question I ask, first of all, is when did it happen? Is it coming into the deep stages of meditation or just at the beginning? Because the best nimitta is obviously, you've got to go through the hoops first of all, you know, present moment awareness, silence, the breath, the beautiful breath. After the beautiful breath, if these things happen, there almost certainly are nimittas. And secondly, you ask about the colour of them. Do you see those sorts of purples or gold in the world? And usually the nimittas are just unworldly colours. They might be purple, but that's only the best description you can have, but they're much richer than any purple you can see in this world, if they're purple. It doesn't matter what colour they are, actually. It can be blue, pink, whatever. But it's a much deeper yellow or deeper pink than ever you've seen before. It's really powerful and rich. And it usually comes with a lot of power, excitement, bliss, joy, and that sort of stuff. And this is, I said in here, it was coming and going with a bright spot in the middle to form another flash. Yeah, the bright spot, the beautiful one, is always in the middle. So that's why that one of the little techniques which I'll mention later on, if a nimitta comes up into your mind and it stays there but it doesn't do anything, in the sense it's not becoming more bright, more brilliant, you can always look to its middle, because in the middle is always the beautiful spot. That's where all the power is. So if you just focus into the middle of a nimitta, then that nimitta just becomes, so that middle becomes like expands, you've got this brilliant nimitta inside, and go into the middle of that, always going into the middle, and that's where the beauty, that's where all the action is, as it were. But in this particular one, the bright spot came up from another flash and then it disappeared again. Couldn't be sustained by the sound of it, so you need to be a bit more still. Shh. Hold it, don't move. It's like there's a burglar behind you. Don't move. Freeze. And then the nimitta stays. And then you can go into the center. And then something wonderful happens. Jhana. Okay, yeah, so it sounds like a nimitta to me. But not strong enough to be sustained. Dear Ajahn Brahm, after your comments about people's obsessional attachment to sports, it occurred to me that the BSWA could form a cricket team called the Anatta 11. And just never turn up for a match. In fact, we could field similar teams for all the sporting codes. Yeah, in one of the books, yeah, this is one being published. I think I did put it in one of the journals. I thought of actually starting a football team, a soccer team, a Buddhist soccer team. But in the Buddhist soccer team, we'd always be passing the ball to the other side out of compassion. They want it more than we do. Here we go, you can have the ball. And If they can't score a goal, we'll score it for them, our own goals. Out of compassion. Eh? If we don't win, that's even better, because we're letting go of self and winning, and we're being humble and stuff like that. So the more we lose, the better. And if at the end of the season we get relegated, well, that's what, you know, relegated out of samsara is. That's like ending rebirth. So we can start a soccer team or a cricket team. We do a cricket team, we make sure we bowl them really nice up. Is this good enough for you so they can really slog it? And if we do catch the ball, we catch the ball, we throw it over the rope. So it's a six every time. Okay. Dear Ajahn, lately I had a problem that the more I practice letting go of meditation, the more my wife attaches on me. She's getting worried. I desperately need Ajahn's advice on the skill of detachment by not hurting her for the sake of my future renunciation to be a full-time Anagarika. So I'm in dilemma. Okay, the best thing to do is to teach her meditation so she lets go of you. She lets go of you first. So teach her how to meditate. Because when you let go in meditation, sometimes people see this. They see you moving further away from them. Because you're becoming sort of more aloof from the world. And of course they get a bit worried. And so they will try and be sort of more tender, more kind, more loving to you, because they see you moving away. That's why it's wonderful if you have a partner who has the same inclination and they can meditate together. Then you can become like a spiritual couple rather than like an attaching couple. You can be called what's called Kalyanamitas, which is the word for, like, you know, noble friends. So you can actually be supportive of each other in the monastic life, or in the spiritual life. And you can be celebrating and enjoying each other's attainments. So if a person wants to go on a retreat, say, oh, wonderful, please do, because sure that, you know, you're not someone who I attach to and get sensory pleasures from, but someone who can inspire me for your peace and your kindness. And, you know, that you can get inspiration from your partner to practice meditation yourself. And so together you walk upon this beautiful path of renunciation, peace, simplicity, or whatever. But it's to be expected. So the only way of dealing with that is to see if you can get her to meditate. And if you can do that, then she won't attach to you. Best way. Next question. Venerable Ajahn, you are a source of energy on the path of Dharma. May you be able to guide many on this noble path. May you be happy. May you all aspirations be fulfilled with metta. Signed, Ajahn Brahm. No, it wasn't. Well, I could ask questions too, can't I? What was I saying about praising yourself? It's a great way to... Last question. What's the time? I can't see this. Oh, quite early. I'll just spin this one out. Uh-oh. What was one of the instructions I gave in the beginning? One question each and only one part. Here is the piece of paper with question one, question two, question three and question four. Never mind. Question one. Dear teacher, is jhana the ultimate goal of all these meditations? There's no goal in the meditations. There's only just letting go. This is why, and I just said that if you have a soccer team, you don't score goals for yourself. You score the goals for the other team. No goals for you. So it's not a goal. It's just what happens, that's all. That's why some people say, oh, these jhanas is just another form of desire, another form of craving, and you get attached to them. But if you crave for them, you'll never get them. You've already found that out. That should have been an insight which each one of you have got so far in this retreat. The more you crave for peace, the less peace comes. If you look at peace as being an attainment, you've missed the point. Peace is a stage of letting go. The more you let go, the more peaceful you are. So it's not a goal. It's completely opposite of a goal.
It's just a letting go. It's an emptiness, an abandoning of goals. And on the stage of abandoning all goals, dana is one of the things which happen. A stage of stillness. Because you find you want to attain something and get somewhere. As soon as you get somewhere, you always want to go somewhere else. Isn't that always the case in your life? All you people who came from Malaysia, as soon as you come here, you want to go somewhere else. You want to go to jhana. And as soon as you get to jhana, you want to go somewhere else. Done that, now what? It's like people who go, they can go to Singapore. So they go to Singapore, now what? Let's go somewhere else. And people spend the whole time always going somewhere else. They go get married, now what? Let's go do something else. They go become a monk, now what? Let's go and do something else. All your goals, as soon as you reach them, the goals are unfaithful to your desire. This is what unfaithfulness is. They always promise, once I achieve this, once you get that, I'll make you happy ever after. But as soon as you get it, it disappoints you. You have to get something else. So don't go for goals. Go for no goals. The letting go of goals. So in jhana, it's a state of letting go, not a goal. The more you let go, the more you abandon, the more you free yourself, the more closer you get to jhanas. And it just happens, that's all. So don't think of goals. Don't think of attainments. Because goals and attainments are always somewhere else. These are where you are. The jhana's right in this very moment. You have jhana in the palm of your hand. You only need to sort of open up your fist to be able to see it. There we go. Well, you know what I mean. It's a metaphor. Number two. If you have attained jhana once, is jhana easily attainable after that? If you have attained jhana once, it's usually very difficult afterwards. What do I mean by that? This is a common occurrence. Because you get it once, and it's amazing, this is so beautiful, it's so wonderful. And it's very hard not to have a craving and a desire for it afterwards. And because of that, this is the most wonderful, beautiful experience of your life. You've heard me say before, better than sex, 1,000 times better than orgasm. And there you have it. Wow, I want that again, please. Unfortunately, the wanting is what causes it not to appear. And it takes you sometimes years or months. If you're smart and got a good teacher, it doesn't take you that long. Because you remember the causes for these jhanas. And you just put the causes into place. You don't go looking for the result. It's like a person doing their washing up. And they see all these plates and dishes in the sink. And they start to think, oh, when is the washing up going to be finished? When are all the dishes going to be clean? I want the dishes to be clean. And of course, they're just wasting time. You never get the dishes clean that way. That's like a person, oh, when's jhana going to happen? I want to get jhana. Let's get to jhana. And that's actually similar to what you actually do. It's stupid, but you can't see it. So, you've washed the dishes before, you know that's the way they get clean. You put them in the sink, squirt a little bit of this, you know, stuff in it, swirl it all around, wash them. And then they get dry and they're nice and clean then. You've done it before, that's the cause for getting the dishes cleaned. So, if you want to get the dishes clean, this is what I have to do. So you just do it. And the dishes in a short while are nice and clean. So after a while, same with jhanas. You've done it before, you know what, how to get jhanas, you've just got to let go. So instead of saying, I want jhanas, when am I going to get jhanas, I need jhanas, why can't I get jhanas, Ajahn Brahm's not a good teacher, I need jhanas, I'll go to another teacher, he'll teach me how to get jhanas, maybe another place, maybe this, that, shut up and just put the dishes in the water and just start washing them. So instead of saying, I want jhanas, just sit on your cushion, let go, follow all the instructions, present moment awareness, more fully in the present moment, silence, watch the breath, beautiful breath, nice nimitta coming up, just do all the stages. And then the jhanas happen. So the trouble is, people forget that. And they think that once they have it once, I can do it. And you actually start to own the jhana. If you own the jhana, you think you control it. I've done it once, now I can do it. Now I can meditate now. You can't meditate. you will never be able to meditate. You have to disappear. Meditation just happens. You don't own it. You don't do it. You get out of the way, and there, meditation just happens. So, this is a problem. Sometimes when we meditate once, we get to jhanas, we think we can do it, we own it, we put the self next to the jhana, and then we can't do it again. Question 3. Is jhana equals nirvana? If it is, do we still need others, like learning the Dhamma, knowledge, skills to make a living, sports or exercise to make the body healthy, marriage, etc.? Is jhana nirvana? It is close to nirvana, which is why the Buddha actually called, when I first read this in the suttas, it was really amazing. The Buddha actually called the experience of jhana, it's just the experience of first jhana, the bliss, the happiness. He gave it a name called Sambodhisukha, which literally does mean enlightenment happiness. And I know already, you know, even at that time when I first read these things, that's not enlightenment. But the very fact the Buddha called it enlightenment happiness meant it was so close to enlightenment. It was like a taste of nirvana. Not the meal, but just the taste. Close enough to make these things hugely important. So no, they're not nirvana, but they're damn close. And another saying of the Buddha, somebody asked me this in the interview. One of my favorite, I said this morning, didn't I? Nati Jananga Panyasa. I think I said this morning, a quote from the Dhammapada. They said, there is no jhana without wisdom. I think I said it in an interview. It's verse 372, the Dhammapada. Nati Jananga Panyasa Panya. Nati ajayato yamhi janang chapanya cha sawe nibbana santike, verse 372, which translates, there is no jhana without wisdom. There is no wisdom without jhana. But in the one who has wisdom and jhana, they are in the presence of nibbana. They are that close. You have wisdom, but no jhana. You have jhana, but no wisdom. You're a long way away. But actually, they all come together. And when you have jhana and wisdom, you, my friend, are that close. So, that's the difference between jhana and wisdom. Get a few jhanas. Something's going to happen. Lastly, is jhana the ultimate goal of life? Jhana is the ultimate own goal of life. You get relegated from the league after you get nirvana. So it's like an own goal. In other words, it's a no goal. There's no goals here. It's just the ending of all goals. That very idea of a goal, a destination, misses the point. It's not a destination, it's an ingression. It's not a terminus. I suppose it's a terminus where everything ends, where the bus journey of life comes to a stop. But it's not at the end of the route. It's right in the very moment. So the bus is still going, but you get off. So you haven't reached the goal. There is no goal. The bus keeps on going round and round and round. It might stop for one night, but it starts again the following day. That's not a destination. The destination is getting off the bus. Getting off the bus of craving, of going here and goals and getting this and going that. Letting go of everything. That's what you do. So, there we go. There's a question for tonight. Any other questions from the floor or from the cushion, direct from the cushion this evening? Okay. So, thank you for those questions this evening. So I hope you like the answers. Is there any complaints about the answers? Anyone want to ask anything else about the answers? No? Good. Great. Okay. So, one of the most important things I said this evening, I'll just reinforce, because it's a great meditation technique. Try not measuring. Give up all measurements. So there's no comparing your meditation. No judging it. No assessing it. This was a peaceful one. This wasn't a peaceful one. this is deep, this is shallow. See if you can stop that. And then you'll find you won't be able to control anymore. Stop judging yourself. I'm doing well. I'm doing terribly. See how much freedom you get when you stop trying to put yourself in a box and give yourself a grade or give meditation a grade. It's called loving kindness. Door of my heart's open no matter what's happening. You don't judge the people you love. You don't judge the meditation. When there's no judging, all control disappears. And then freedom arises. Great. Give it a try. But if you do it, you've got to do it 100%. You can't say, I'm not doing any measuring, it doesn't work. If you say it works, it doesn't work, that's more measuring. It just is, that's all. So just meditation is. Okay. So, see what happens. Maybe we get a few people into the measureless, what's it called, the measureless liberation this evening. A few more arahats this evening here, because they don't measure anything. Okay, off you go. See you tomorrow morning. Hopefully all enlightened. If not, you're going to have to sit again, do the same thing for another whole day. Oh. Okay, good night.